Welcome to episode 23 of the Fredcast for the week of July the 3rd, 2006. My name is David, and I'm a Fred. Welcome to another episode of the Fredcast. I'm glad to have you with me. This is a big week in cycling. The Tour de France has begun, and I have a lot of news for you all about the Tour, and unfortunately, all about doping as well. In addition, got some info for the you Mac users who've been looking for that Garmin software for your Garmin Edge, a new recumbent hour record, and a bunch of other news. Following that, our new segment, Bents on the Fredcast, some more software for your pocket PC or Palm for the Tour de France, short Tour de France viewing guide, and much more. So sit back, relax, and if you're riding your bike, hammer just a little bit harder, because here comes the Fredcast. Well, welcome back to the Fredcast. I am recording this show on Tuesday, July the 4th, which is a holiday here in the United States. So happy 4th of July to all of my American listeners. If you're from Canada, I hope you had a good holiday this weekend and that you enjoyed yourselves. So again, this is sort of an unusual one. I'm actually recording this one during the daytime, which means you could hear all sorts of sounds from my household. Family sounds, dog sounds, people out in the street, you never know. So if you hear a little couple of things in the background, please just ignore it. That's what happens when I'm actually recording this one when other people are awake. So the Tour de France has begun, and I got to tell you, so far it looks like a really, really exciting event. It looks like it's shaping up to be really a very open field for this year's Tour. A lot of battles going on, so we're going to get right down into the Tour de France news. I'll let you know where we are up until now, which so far we've gone through stage number 3. So first, and perhaps most importantly, I have good news for you, and that is that following the revelations of June the 30th and the number of riders that were suspended from this year's Tour de France, the cycling world did not end. As a matter of fact, everybody got up as planned on July the 1st, and most of the riders that were planning on being in the Tour de France actually did start the race, although some of them may have started a little bit late, and I'll tell you about that in a second. But on July the 1st, there was the prologue in this year's Tour de France. It was a 7.1-kilometer individual time trial through the streets of Strasbourg. Strasbourg's a beautiful, beautiful town in France, and this was a great race. It was really exciting. In the end, Crédit Agricole's Tor Hushovd, who's normally not known to be somebody who's going to necessarily win time trials, he set a blistering pace. And although George Hincapie really looked like he was going to be able to beat him, in the end, he came up just a little bit short by about 0.73 of a second. So a little bit of a heartbreaker there for George. But I think the real heartbreaker of the day was Floyd Landis, because if you've watched a time trial before, if you ever watched a skiing race, you know that the way that it works is you've got a particular time slot within which you're supposed to start. And you get into the start house, and then the timer starts beeping down. And when it hits your time, there's a change in tone, and boom, you're supposed to be out on the course. Well, when it came time for Floyd to start, the start house was there, the beeping was happening, the timer was counting down, there was no Floyd. As a matter of fact, Floyd ended up starting about 8 or 9 seconds late, and I'm sure that not only did he start late, but his rhythm was probably off a little bit. Found out later that it was because his team wanted to change his wheel. They didn't like the way his tire looked. Apparently there was a slash in it. And the last thing you want in a time trial, of course, is to get a blowout on the course. So he started late, and besides starting late, I'm sure his rhythm was off. So in the end, he came up about 9 seconds short of the leader, and that starting late could have been the difference for him between victory and only being in the top 10 of the time trial. So at the end of the day, Tor Hushovd was wearing the yellow jersey. Second place went to George Hincapie. He was just 1 second behind, or really a fraction of a second behind. And third place, last year's prologue winner, Dave Zabriskie from the United States, from Team CSC, at just 4 seconds behind. So the prologue was really exciting. It was a great, great day of racing, and really set the stage for the first real stage in the Tour de France, which was stage number 1 the following day, 185 kilometers from Strasbourg to Strasbourg, including a quick jaunt into Germany. The stage was mostly flat, with one small Category 4 climb at 101 kilometers. It was an interesting stage in that George Hincapie, who usually doesn't go after some of these intermediate sprints, and if you don't know what these are, stand by. I'm going to get to those a little bit later when I give you sort of a Tour de France viewing guide. George normally doesn't go after these intermediate sprints, but I think he had a really great strategy that day, and he ended up winning one of the intermediate sprints, and as a result, getting a time bonus, so that at the end of the day, even though the stage was won by Frenchman Jimmy Casper of the Cofidis team, at the end of the day, George Hincapie was wearing yellow, and Tor Hushovd was in second place, just 2 seconds behind. Third place, still, Dave Zabriskie from CSC, 6 seconds behind. Interestingly, two Australians in the top 10 in the general classifications following stage one. Stuart O'Grady from CSC at 6 seconds behind. Michael Rogers from T-Mobile at 8 seconds behind. And there again in ninth place, Floyd Landis from Phonak, 11 seconds behind. Now, the Tour de France is one in which things can change from second to second. And imagine at the beginning of this stage, Tor Hushovd was wearing yellow. By the end of the stage, Tor Hushovd was on the ground and bleeding. What ended up happening was just about 50 meters before the finish line, apparently some people associated with the tour, some sponsors, had passed out these large green hands. Sort of remind you of if you're from the United States and you go to a football game or a baseball game, people have these foam fingers, so these number one fingers that they wave around to support their team. And so this sponsor or somebody had passed out these large green hands. And the hands, from what I understand, are cardboard, but they've got a plastic laminate over them. So you can imagine that they do have the potential of being pretty sharp. Well, Hushovd got a little bit close to the fans in the last 50 meters, got very close to the edge of the road. And there was a fan who was waving around one of these hands, and it sliced across his right arm, just around the biceps. And you could see in the video as they slowed it down, as he went across the finish line, he was already bleeding pretty good from his arm. And you could see him on the TV coverage lying on the ground. They were putting pressure on that arm. And for a while, it really looked like you weren't sure whether or not he was going to be able to even continue the race. The nice thing was after, you know, a few stitches, he was able to come back the next day for the stage two of the Tour de France, and he was able to race. And he's kind of glad that he did. Now, stage two, 228.5 kilometers from Aubernay to Esch-sur-Alzette. And this one showed a little bit more climbing than in the previous two days. And this one was really interesting because Hushovd, who had been really what appeared to be severely injured the day before, came back and he sort of had a show of what I call turnabout is fair play. He ended up using George Hincapie's own strategy to retake the yellow jersey by winning two third-place intermediate sprints, therefore earning enough time bonuses to retake the yellow jersey. Now, the stage victory went to Robbie McEwen from Australia, who timed his final sprint perfectly, and he ended up beating also another famous sprinter, world champion Tom Bonin from Belgium, as well as Tor Hushovd for the stage win. At the line, it even looked like Hushovd and Bonin's wheels may have touched a little bit, because as Hushovd came across the line, he had clipped out of his left pedal, and he was struggling to figure out how to get it back in there, and he was definitely a little bit off balance. Bonin was really, really excited, and it is exciting because this is actually his ninth Tour de France stage win. So congratulations to Tom Bonin for that. But at the end of the day, Tor Hushovd was wearing yellow. Second place was Tom Bonin. Third, Robbie McEwen. Fourth, George Hincapie from Discovery, still just 10 seconds behind. And in fifth place, there's Dave Zabriskie from CSC, 16 seconds behind. So stage two, really exciting finish, and a really great finish for Tom Bonin from Belgium. And really exciting for him, because this is the part of the tour where we're finally starting to head north a little bit, and we're heading up towards Luxembourg and Belgium and the Netherlands before heading back into France in a couple of days. Now, at the end of stage two, T-Mobile's Matthias Kessler had been really jockeying himself into position to try to win the final sprint to the finish and win the stage. He really feels that he's got something to prove now that T-Mobile's Jan Ulrich has been excluded from this year's race. And he really wants to In one way, he wants to win a stage for Jan. And another way, really prove that the T-Mobile team is still in this race and is still a contender, even without Jan Ulrich, the pre-race favorite. But he didn't do it at stage two. He really didn't time it very well. Then came today's stage three, July 4th. Today's stage three was a 216.5-kilometer race from Esch-sur-Alzette all the way up to Valkenburg. And at the end of this race, there's a very famous climb called the Cowberg. And the reason why it's critical and why it's important in this is because if you look at today's elevation profile, you saw that in the beginning there were a few rolling hills up and down, but then you got into some Category 3 and Category 4 climbs, and then at the end, a final non-categorized climb, which is called the Cowberg, which apparently, according to all of the commentators, is really like a brick wall. And so no matter how you were doing before you got to the Cowberg, once you hit this brick wall, if your legs weren't there, if your lungs weren't there, you were going to be toast. And it was very interesting to see what happened. In the end, T-Mobile's Matthias Kessler did take today's tough 216-kilometer stage, and he did it by chasing down José Luis Arrieta from the AG2R team. And Arrieta had been winning or leading the stage for a very long time today. And then in the end, in just a surge of energy, here came Kessler, and he ended up overtaking Arrieta and then outsprinting Michael Bogaert on the final climb, that Cowberg climb, to end up winning the stage. Now, what was really great about this from a T-Mobile perspective was that not only did Kessler take the stage victory, but in second place was his teammate, Michael Rogers from Australia. So they take a 1-2 in today's stage, and I think in the end they were very, very pleased about that. Now, third place in today's stage went to Daniel Bonatti from Italy. But the big story was really the fact that Tom Bonin took fourth place in today's stage, because by doing so, he ended up catapulting himself into first place in the general classification and, of course, into the yellow jersey. Now, Bonin is also the leader for the green jersey points, and I'm going to tell you about that a little bit later. But since you can't wear two jerseys at the same time in the Tour, Bonatti, who is sitting in second place for the green points, will end up in green in tomorrow's fourth stage. Tomorrow's fourth stage is a 207-kilometer stage from Huy back down to Saint-Quentin, which is back in France. So at the end of today's stage, and sitting right now as we stand in the Tour de France, here's your top 10 standings in the general classification. In first place is Tom Bonin from Quickstep. Second place, Michael Rogers from T-Mobile at only 1 second behind. Third is George Hincapie from Discovery at 5 seconds. Fourth, Tor Hushov from Credit Agricole at 7 seconds. Fifth, Paolo Salvadelli from Italy and the Discovery team at 15 seconds. There's Daniel Bonatti in sixth place from Lamprey at 15 seconds behind. Floyd Landis from Phonak in the United States, 16 seconds behind. Vladimir Karpets from Russia, from the Castas de Epargne Iles Baleares team at 17 seconds behind. Ninth place, Sergei Honchar from the Ukraine and the T-Mobile team at 17 seconds behind. And in 10th place, today's stage winner, Matthias Kessler from Germany and the T-Mobile team at 17 seconds behind the leader. Now, as you know, the Fredcast is only really recorded once a week, and I usually do this on Monday nights so that it appears on Tuesday morning. However, today I wanted to wait until the stage was over and all of the news was in before I recorded it so that I could give you as much information as possible so that you don't have to wait too long to get all of your information. But in the meantime, because I am only recording once a week, what I have gone ahead and done is every day I'm posting onto thefredcast.com, into the blog, I'm giving you a little short summary of the day's events in that days of racing at the Tour. And just for really, really quick reference, I'm putting a image of the team jersey of the leader of the Tour right into the blog page. So if you just want quick news, exactly who won today's stage, who's winning in the general classification, what team's in the lead, go ahead and go to the Fredcast every day. It may take me an hour or two until after the stage is over before I post the information, but it's going to give you a real quick hit of information of what's going on in the Tour de France and what had happened in that day's racing. Now, depending on where you are in the world, you may be able to watch the racing live on your local television. For instance, here in the United States, you can watch it live on OLN, the Outdoor Life Network. That's the network whose name will soon be Versus. But if you go to the main webpage for the Tour de France, and I've put a link in the show notes, it's letour.fr. Right there in the middle of the page, you're going to see the listing of stations around the world which are showing the Tour de France live for you as it's happening. Now, here in the United States, OLN is pretty much all cycling all the time now because they show the tour and then they show some recaps, and then again later in the evening, they've got what they call their enhanced version where they start doing some commentary and analysis and interviews with riders, as well as showing some of the highlights of the day's racing. Now, unfortunately, for those of you who like watching the race on the internet, cycling.tv does not offer live race coverage. But what they do have is they do have a live Tour de France show every day where you're getting commentary and analysis while the race is going on. So I'm sure it's a contractual thing where they're not actually able to show the footage coming to you live from the race course. But if you are at your office and you need to get a fix and you can't watch TV, I would say head over to cycling.tv and check it out, because at least you're going to be getting updates. Now, in addition to that, you can also go to the Tour de France website where they're giving you updates moment to moment on things that have happened in the racing in the Tour de France. So there's a lot of ways that you can really stay up to date besides surfing around to various websites. So go ahead and check that out. And by the way, for those of you who are Macintosh users, and if you've got one of the new Intel-based Macs, you may have had some problems using cycling.tv so far with your Intel-based Mac. Well, wait till the feature section after the news. I'm going to give you some information about some tweaks that you can do that will allow you to use the cycling.tv website with your new Intel-based Mac. Okay, but there is other news in the world of cycling, and unfortunately, the first thing I've got to lead with is just a few more stories about this whole doping scandal going on. Now, we've talked before about the World Anti-Doping Agency, or WADA, and their chairman, Dick Pound. Now, Pound was interviewed late last weekend by BBC Radio, and what he said, you know my feelings on this. I agree exactly with what he said. He said, quote, talking about cycling, quote, "The image of your sport and its flagship event is in the toilet." And I think he's right. I think that's exactly what I said to you last week. He went on to say, quote, "You've got to do something about it or risk that your sport will be ignored by everybody, marginalized by others, and it won't be a sport anymore." Now, on Saturday, the head of the UCI, Pat McQuaid, said, quote, "If ultimately these guys," talking about Jan Ullrich and Ivan Basso and even talking about Tyler Hamilton, "ultimately if these guys are proven guilty," he said, "and their careers are over and they get 4 years, I have no sympathy for them." Now, I totally agree with him, and I totally agree with Dick Pound. I think that this entire scandal has rocked the world of cycling, and it has really put cycling in a very bad light. Let me ask you a question. If you listen to this podcast, you're a cyclist. Your friends and family know that you're a cyclist. So here's my question to you. How many times over the last couple of days has somebody come up to you and said something like, "So, what do you think about this whole thing? All these cyclists are on drugs." Or how many people have come up to you and said, "Hey, I really think that this means that Armstrong was doping." It has transcended normal cycling fans and gotten to the same level as, for instance, the Barry Bonds scandal in professional baseball in the United States. Everybody now believes that cyclists are using drugs in order to get a competitive advantage over their competition. So many people have come up to me and said, "Well, this probably proves that Armstrong was doping. And it proves that his doctors were better than anybody else's because that they were able to hide the fact that he was doping." Now, I choose not to believe that Lance was doping. I choose not to believe that even Ullrich and Basso were doping, because remember, they haven't been found guilty of anything. As a matter of fact, I got a great email from listener Casey in Valencia, California. I'm going to read it to you because I think that it's very important that we have this dialogue. He said, "David, like you, I'm very upset by the scandal at this year's Tour de France. It's terribly unfair to riders who have trained for years and dedicated their young lives to finding a spot in the world's most prestigious peloton. These young men have not been convicted of anything. It's a classic example of guilt by association. It's especially tragic that it happened just as Ullrich was peaking. It's also terribly unfair to us, the fans, which is what I said last week. We're being deprived of our chance to watch Jan and Yvonne. Worse, if Landis or Hincappy or Zabriskie or Leipheimer or anybody else in the Peloton, for that matter, if they win, their victory will be tainted by Jan and Yvonne's absence, just as Lance's first victory was tainted by Pantani's absence in 1999. And I think he's right. You know, there's always going to be that asterisk there, because if Jan and Yvonne are found innocent, there's going to be that asterisk. Yes, whoever won this year's tour, they won. But could they have won if these two guys had been in the race? One more thing, he says. My attitude is more cynical than yours. I've spent no time around pro cyclists, but I believe that the entire pro peloton dopes. It probably began with a few bad eggs trying to get an unfair advantage. Now all the pros are doping in self-defense. Tragic? Sure. But I believe it's a fact of life. Do I hope I'm wrong? Fervently. But I doubt it. I hope you're wrong too, Casey, but I think it is entirely possible. Do we know? No, neither you nor I know. We just have been really hurt by this scandal. It really is unfair to all of us. And as I said last week, and as I will continue saying, I hope the allegations are untrue, but it really has put cycling in a very bad light, and I just wish real sportsmanship would come back to sports. Okay, rant is over for now, but very interestingly, I found another story this week where Pat McQuaid is now saying that it's entirely possible. Remember, Pat McQuaid is the head of the UCI. Pat McQuaid is saying, quote, only riders have been named so far. But, he went on to say, many footballers, tennis players, and other athletes are on the same list as these cyclists in this Operación Puerto scandal. So the bottom line is, so far we've only heard about cyclists, but when this thing really opens up, there's every possibility that some of your other sporting heroes, some of these other athletes that people look up to, may also be implicated in this doping scandal. So it's going to be a huge story for a very, very long time. Now, meanwhile, of course, all the riders that have been implicated in this scandal that were barred from this year's tour, of course, have come out with press releases and statements adamantly denying any guilt in this scandal and asserting their innocence. And one of those, of course, was Vinokourov. Now, Vinokourov was not implicated in the scandal, but he wasn't allowed to participate in the tour because so many other riders on his team were implicated that they didn't have the minimum number necessary in order to field a team in the Tour de France. Well, now you'll remember that his team was originally called Liberty Seguros. Then, when Liberty pulled out, they became the Astana Wirth team. Now, Wirth has pulled out, and now it is only Astana. And Vinokourov has said that's fine with him. Next year, it's going to be an all-Kazakh team, and they're going to be dominant, and he's going to come back to the Tour de France. So, no more Liberty Seguros, no more Astana Wirth. Now, it's just Astana. And if it's up to Vino, it looks like it's going to be only Kazakhs that are on the team. Now, in a final bit of doping news for the week, and hopefully the final bit of doping news for a while, just as this scandal was really exploding in the Tour de France, a trial was ending in Bordeaux, France, where former cycling trainer Freddie Sargent was jailed for 4 years because he ended up giving drug cocktails to riders. And these drug cocktails apparently included amphetamines, cocaine, and heroin. And he gave these to cyclists in France and in Belgium. And this was a big drug scandal when it first happened. So it's good to see that they're actually giving these people some harsh sentences for interfering in the sporting world. Now, there were other sentences that came down. Sargent was also fined about $230,000. His wife was given a 1-year prison term, and there were other sentences. They ranged everywhere from 1,500 euros to a 30-month prison term, and 20 of those sentences were suspended. So they are giving out fines for these things, and hopefully this will start keeping people from wanting to be involved in doping to begin with, but we will see what happens. Whew, 25 minutes into the podcast, and all we've talked about is the Tour de France and doping. Well, there's not a whole lot of other news this week because it only has been a few days since the last podcast. But one that I definitely wanted to bring to you was about Garmin and their promise of supplying Mac software for those of us with Garmin Edges and Forerunners and other Garmin GPSs. Well, you may recall that we talked at the very beginning of 2006 that at the Macworld Expo in San Francisco, Garmin had promised to have Mac support by the spring of 2006. Well, spring has come and gone, and so far, nothing. Well, Garmin released a press release on June the 27th announcing a new update on the launch of its application for Mac OS X Tiger. And they're now saying that their training center software is expected to be compatible with Mac OS X by the end of 2006. So that's about a six-month delay from their original plan of having it ready in the spring. And they said, quote, "We thank the Mac community for their support, understanding, and patience as we work through unanticipated delays, and we look forward to providing Mac users with direct support for their Garmin products." Now, in the meantime, people who have the Intel-based Macs have been finding various ways to connect their Garmin products to those Macs. And from what I've learned, the most successful way of doing this is by installing Apple's Bootcamp software, which allows you to have a dual boot machine. So you can either be booted into Mac OS X or you can be booted into Windows XP. And when you are, it's just like operating a Windows PC. And then you can hook up your hardware directly to your computer and it works just fine. Now, the other way is to use a piece of software called Parallels. And Parallels provides virtualization technology, which allows you to run Windows XP alongside Mac OS X. Now, I've used both. The Bootcamp software works very, very well, and it's running a PC native on an Intel platform. The Parallel software also works great, and there is just the most minor of speed hits. It's barely even noticeable. And if you ran the Parallel software and you've been running a Windows PC that was built 6 months or more ago, you wouldn't notice any difference. The problem, however, is apparently the USB drivers for Garmin are just a little bit tricky, and so far nobody has been able to run a Forerunner or an Edge under the Parallels virtualization technology. But I do believe that the Parallels people are working on this and that they're getting closer. So be patient. I think it's coming. And when it does, I'll be the first to let you know, because that's my preferred way of using Windows on my Intel-based MacBook Pro. Here's a piece of news from Rick, who provides the Bents on the Fredcast segment all about recumbents. And he writes, "At approximately 6:20 a.m. on July 2nd, 2006, 20 years after winning the DuPont Prize, Fast Freddie Markham set his 20th world record, winning the prestigious Dempsey McCready Hour Record Prize. Fast Freddie covered a distance of 53.43 miles in 1 hour, bettering the previous record by over 1 mile. Fast Freddie and the Easy Racers team received an $18,000 prize for the fastest 1 hour in history. Over $40,000 was awarded to the participants. It was a fantastic event, and Fast Freddie proved to the world that after more than three decades of racing, he's still a world-class athlete." Now, Rick, as you know, is a dyed-in-the-wool recumbent rider, and so he wanted to jab it to the rest of us who are conventional bicycle riders when he writes, "P.S., I think the one-hour road bike record is less than 35 miles." So congratulations to Freddie Markham and his team, the Easy Racers, on a really amazing feat, 53.43 miles in 1 hour. And thanks, Rick, for supplying us with that piece of news. Very, very much appreciated. And in the final bit of news tonight, it's more of a programming note. As you may know, the Race Across America was going on over the last couple of weeks. And unfortunately, it was all taking place when I was on vacation. I really didn't follow it closely enough. And so I didn't feel that I could provide you with enough news about it because I just didn't have the personal knowledge. So forgive me for that. But what I can bring you is the fact that the 2006 Race Across America is going to be featured on television here in the United States on, believe it or not, the Weather Channel. There's a show on the Weather Channel called Road Crew, and it's hosted by a guy by the name of Jeff Mealcars. And there's going to be four brief segments on RAM that's going to be airing over the next few days, July the 5th, 6th, 8th, and 9th. And I've put in the show notes the schedule of the days that it's going to be on the Weather Channel. So go ahead and check it out. I think it's great that Ram's going to be getting a little bit of coverage. I think the Weather Channel is a strange place to put it, but I'm going to watch and see exactly why it is that they put it on there. But for those people who did participate in Ram, congratulations. I know that somebody that I used to know way back when I was in the bicycle industry, Tinker Juarez, who was a phenomenal mountain bike racer, somebody who I used to sponsor back in the late 80s and early 90s. Tinker did this year's Ram, and I read an article by him in which he said that it was perhaps the most difficult thing he's ever done in his entire life, and I don't doubt it. So congratulations to everybody that participated, whether you finished or not. Congratulations to all of the finishers. And on a personal note, congratulations to my old friend Tinker. That is a great feat, and I promise all of you Fredcast listeners, next year I hope not to be on vacation when it happens, and I'll try to bring you a little bit more news of Race Across America when it happens. And that's going to do it for the news. It's time for Rick's Bents on the Fredcast segment.
Thanks, David. This is Rick near Galveston, where we've been trying to get the space shuttle back into orbit at NASA's Johnson Space Center. And today's segment continues the discussion on bicycle design. I'm going to call it No Perfect Bike. We're going to limit the duration of the Bents segment to just 3 to 4 minutes here during the Tour de France. So if you feel like the segment's cut in the middle, we'll have the next portion next week. The best figures available indicate that air resistance is a much bigger factor than weight when it comes to cycling efficiency, especially when considering flatland travel. Counting each gram of bike and payload isn't a bad idea, but it isn't enough to guarantee the fastest possible ride. That's because 90% of your energy drain goes into fighting wind resistance at ground speeds above 12 to 15 miles an hour. And most of us are going faster than that, so it makes sense that decreasing your surface area windwise will allow you to plow more of your wattage into velocity. There are two common ways used to cut wind resistance. The first is fairings, or body socks, or streamlined body covers. They all work together to create a smooth laminar flow and to reduce energy-wasting turbulence. Although a few fairings have been made for road bikes, they cover very little of the bike's effective frontal area. Fairings and other energy reduction technologies are common on Bents, with some models coming with stock fairings, custom-designed, even wind-tested for performance. Less common are body socks and complete enclosures, often made of ultralight materials, which hide all the messy bike and human parts, leaving the wind to flow over a shape reflective of a fish or an aircraft. Homemade air enhancements for Bents are often created because very little structural strength is required, and materials such as that plastic material used for political yard signs is readily available. Commercial fairings made of polycarbonate or other materials, on the other hand, can run the cost of your ride up quickly. Fairings also help when riding in cold weather, and some may even keep bugs out of your teeth. The other technology available to bike designers in the eternal battle against wind is minimizing the frontal area of the bike and rider by modifying the basic frame layout. Laying the rider back to an almost fully reclined position with the feet slightly above and in front of the body ideally results in a bike that, when viewed from the front, is pretty much just a pair of bike shoes. Contrast that with the frontal image of a road bike with the rider in full tuck position. You can still see the rider's head, hands, shoulders, legs, feet, pedals, and large front tire. It's a telling difference in the reason that Bents have been banned from sanctioned races. They give the clever, second-rate rider an edge over the best world-class rider on an upright bike with a larger wind-catching surface area. That 90% energy difference adds up quickly, even though most upright racing bikes come in at a fraction of the racing Bent weights. Some lowrider designs go even further by reducing the front wheel size to, say, a 406 tire and placing the reclined rider just centimeters off the ground. Small tires are supposed to have a higher rolling resistance, and many lowriders check out at 37 pounds or more, but it is the wind that makes the difference in the final stats. The exception to all this is hill climbing. Weight carries, well, more weight when you have to pull it uphill. On the flats, you're fighting wind resistance and frictional losses. On the hills, you're elevating mass. Still, in a recent Ram, Race Across America, the victor was an all-Bent team, which included a number of dedicated hill climbers. Bents can be designed for racing on flats, climbing hills, or for downhill or even velodrome work. Since there are no perfect bikes, it is generally possible to engineer a faster and more efficient two-wheeler for any given set of constraints. That may be one reason that some Bent riders have more than one style of recumbent bike in their garages, or it may be that it's just more fun to look at the problem in different ways. The website of the week is www.rans.com.
Thanks, Rick, for another great segment on recumbents. I'm telling you, I know nothing about these, so I'm learning a lot every week. Now, Rick was talking about the fact that his website of the week is www.rans.com. That's RANS.com. And when you get there, you'll want to click on the bikes link, because what you'll notice is that RANS is also an aircraft company that builds recumbents and all sorts of other bikes. And there's even a column on the website by the owner of RANS on various aspects of bicycle design. So if you click on the link for informative articles, you will see these articles that he's written. Now, Rick wants to point out that once again, he has no connection with the site, other than the fact that he thinks that there's a lot of great information for us there. So thanks, Rick, again for this week's episode. We look forward to your next episode next week. Okay, with the Tour de France going on, you may recall that last week I told you about a piece of software for your Palm OS device that would allow you to track the Tour de France. And I have to tell you, I've been using that nonstop as I've been watching the tour, as I've been preparing for the podcast, as I've been writing the news on thefredcast.com. It's been invaluable to me. And then I got an email a couple of days ago from listener Jerry in Tucson, Arizona, about a similar piece of software. Again, it's freeware for the Pocket PC. And he sent along the links, and I put them in the show notes. So that's something I think you're going to want to check out. So now there's software for both the Palm and the Pocket PC that will allow you to get all the information that you need on the riders, the teams, the stages, where the sprints are, what the team rosters are, what the elevation profiles look like. And the links for both of those pieces of software are in the show notes, one for Pocket PC or Windows Mobile, and one for Palm OS. So go ahead and check those out and install those as soon as you can so that you too can use them as your reference as this year's Tour de France rolls along. So with all the talk about the Tour de France and it being cycling's biggest event of the year, at least as far as most people are concerned, I thought that we might want to just have a brief sort of review or a viewing guide, if you will, of the Tour de France. What should you be looking for when you watch? Because you know, these races take 5-6 hours, depending on how long each individual stage is. And, you know, you see the racers take off and then get reeled in by the peloton. Why would they do that? What's going on? What's with all these different colored jerseys? And maybe this is your first time watching the tour, even though Lance just won 7. Maybe this is your very first exposure to the Tour de France. Now, the first thing I've done is, in the show notes, I put a link to a Wikipedia article, which is pretty good and talks a lot about the tour, a lot about its history, gives you an idea about how the jerseys work. But let's talk about that first and foremost. Let's talk about the jerseys in the Tour de France. Well, first, everybody is pretty familiar with the maillot jaune, or the so-called yellow jersey. Now, the yellow jersey is worn by the rider who, at the end of every stage, has the shortest cumulative time when you add up all of the times from all of the previous stages. So, for instance, right now in the tour, the yellow jersey winner, the person who's going to wear it in tomorrow's stage, is Tom Bonin. And the reason for that is that over the last several days, since the tour began on July the 1st, he has completed all of the stages in the shortest amount of time total when they're all added up, including any time bonuses that he may have won for winning sprints or, for instance, for winning a stage. So there are bonuses out there, and we're going to talk a little bit about that again in a minute. But the bottom line is the yellow jersey winner is the one who leads what's called the general classification, and the general classification is those riders who have the fastest overall time. So when we get all the way to Paris at the end of the tour, at the end of the month, we get to the Champs-Élysées, the person who ends that day, having completed the entire Tour de France from the prologue all the way to the Champs-Élysées in the least amount of time, including time bonuses, that's who ends up getting the final yellow jersey and is crowned the winner of the 2006 Tour de France. But there are other things that you can win in the Tour de France. So next up is the green jersey. And again, Tom Bonin is currently the holder of the green jersey. Now, the green jersey is worn by the rider who has the most points in the race. So now there's time, and then there's points. And the way that you win points is, again, by winning intermediate sprints, and by winning stages. So what's an intermediate sprint? How do you win one of these? Well, an intermediate sprint is an arbitrary line on the road that the riders know about in advance, and there are markers along the route telling them when they're getting close to these intermediate sprints. And there are specific riders in the Tour de France who are known as sprinters. These are people who just can really give it their all for those very short distances to try to beat other riders to that line. And when they do, when you're the first person, the second person, or the third person across that line, you win time bonuses and you win points. So that typically by the end of the Tour de France, the one who ends up getting that last green jersey is one of the best sprinters in the world, because they're the ones who, no matter where they are, no matter how hot it is, no matter how grueling the day's stage has been, no matter how far they've ridden, they've still got that extra burst of energy to beat the rest of the peloton to the line. And that's the green jersey. Now, the next jersey that they're going after is the so-called polka dot jersey. You've seen this one. It's white with big red polka dots on it. This is for the so-called King of the Mountains. Now, you know, if you've been watching, that they really haven't gotten into any major mountain ranges. They haven't gotten to the Alps. They haven't gone to the Pyrenees. Nothing major when it comes to mountain ranges. So how is it that somebody already has that polka dot jersey as the so-called King of the Mountains? Well, on many of the climbs that the riders do during the Tour de France, again, there's an arbitrary line at the top of that climb. And again, there's markers along the road to tell them when they're getting close to it. And the first person to cross that line gets points in the King of the Mountains jersey. And again, at the end of the race, the person who has the most points, who's won the most climbs, leaves with that final polka dot jersey and is crowned King of the Mountains for 2006. Now, the final jersey that they're going after, this is for the younger guys. This is for the best placed rider in the general classification. So remember, the GC is for time only. The best rider, the highest ranked rider in the GC, who's 25 years or younger. So it's the best young rider in the Tour de France. So that's what they're going after this year in the Tour de France. They're going after these jerseys. Now, along the way, you want to look for these individual sprints, and you want to look for the tops of these climbs. And one of the great ways to do that is to go to the Tour de France website, and for each day, they list where in each of the day's routes, where you're going to find an intermediate sprint, where you're going to find a summit. And this, again, is how George Hincapie won the yellow jersey a couple days ago, how Tor Hushovd won it back yesterday, was by going after these intermediate sprints. And so you want to look for those. Another way to find those, again, is that software that I told you about earlier for the Palm Pilot and for the Pocket PC, because it's in there. And if you have that on your Palm or on your Pocket PC while you're watching the stage, you'll be able to follow along and know, maybe before the commentators know, or before the commentators tell everybody else, when these sprints and when the tops of these mountains are coming up. Now, in addition, something that a lot of people ask about is you'll hear them talk about the classification of climbs. And I want to thank listener George for sending me an email. This is a few weeks ago now, almost a month ago, sending me an email on how they classify the various climbs in the Tour de France. So you'll hear them talking about a fourth category climb, or a first category climb, or a beyond category climb. I don't speak French, but I believe it's hors catégorie in French, which is beyond category. So what's the difference between these climbs? Which one's harder? Which one's easier? And first of all, to make it very basic, the easiest of climb is the fourth category climb, moving up third, second, first, and then finally the beyond category climb, which means it's impossible for them to categorize it because it's so difficult. Now, from George's email and the article that he sent to me, it appears that there are some objective criteria that are used from year to year to categorize these climbs. And for instance, some of the things that he told me about, in a fourth category or the lowest category of climb, these are climbs of anywhere from 200 to 500 feet, or for those of you who are in the metric system, 70 to 150 meters. Third category, 500 to 1600 feet, 150 to 500 meters. Second category, 1600 to 2700 feet, or 500 to 800 meters. First category, climbs of 2700 to 5000 feet, or 800 to 1500 meters. And then the beyond category climbs are the hardest, climbs of 5000 feet or more, or 1500 meters or more. But then the article went on to explain that there's a lot of subjective criteria as well that go in there. Now, of course, included in this, steepness does play some sort of a factor, so that, for instance, a lot of the biggest climbs, for instance, in the Alps are about 7 to 8% grades, where the big climbs in the Pyrenees are about 8 to 9% grade. But the subjective criteria come in where you look at some of these climbs where over the years, maybe they'd been a first category climb, and then all of a sudden, miraculously, the next year, same road, all of a sudden, it's been lowered down to maybe a second or third category climb. So there's some controversy that goes in here, maybe a little bit of fudging on the part of the officials, but that's sort of a general guideline for you. The tougher the climb, the higher the category, lower the number. So don't let that confuse you when you're watching the tour. Now, beyond the categorization of the mountains, there are also a number of famous stages in the Tour de France. And of course, among these, the most famous of stages, perhaps, is that final one, the Champs-Élysées in Paris. That's going to be your most famous stage because that's the one that everybody has seen, whether it was Greg LeMond or whether it was Lance Armstrong or any of the other great Tour winners. This is where we've seen them in their most celebratory moments as they're coming into Paris and winning their Tour de France, their final yellow jersey. Now, another very famous stage is perhaps the one that is on the tough Alpe d'Huez. Now, a few years ago, that stage actually ended at the top of the Alpe d'Huez. And one of the things that's interesting about some of these mountain stages is the way that the spectators behave on some of these mountain stages. Because, for instance, a few years ago, as the riders were heading up the Alpe d'Huez, and it's a very tough climb, it's very grueling, the spectators were actually surrounding the riders. I mean, they get within inches, they touch the riders, and they sort of part as the riders are heading up the hill in front of them. And it can be a very, very scary time for the riders. I know that Lance was really hassled by some of the French fans. Some of the riders have been spat on. They throw things at the riders. It's really, really a very tough thing to do as you're slogging it up this hill and you've got fans screaming at you, literally inches from your ear. And if you're not one of their favorites, they can really be hassling you. And, you know, for you and me, if we were out riding and somebody did some of this, we'd call the police. But for these guys, they've got to continue racing and continue to try to win. So look for the Alpe d'Huez to be a very popular stage in this year's Tour de France. And that stage takes place on July the 18th. It's a 187-kilometer stage from Gap to Alpe d'Huez. And again, Alpe d'Huez is a beyond category climb, and that should be a very, very interesting stage. So that's always an interesting one to watch out for. Okay, so what else should you be watching for? Well, I'm going to answer a couple of questions that I've been asked by my kids over the last couple of days as I've been watching the Tour de France, because they had a lot of questions. They had asked me about the jerseys and what the different jerseys meant. They asked me about the fans and how close they get, especially after Tor Hushovd got injured earlier in the week. They wanted to know how the racers, well, how do they eat when they're out there on their bikes? Because they know that when I do a century or double metric or like the double century I'm getting ready for, they know that I can stop at a rest stop and that the rest stops are regularly spaced and I get my peanut butter and jelly and my Fig Newtons. Fig Newtons, by the way, are the whole reason why I do centuries. They wanted to know how these guys eat. Well, it's real simple. There is a bag called a musette. And a musette has a little string on it and just a little pouch. And in the pouch, the team staff put in sandwiches and energy bars and gels and all sorts of things that the riders want to eat. And a lot of times they're personalized for each individual rider. And the team staff will stand at a designated feed zone for the riders. And as the riders go by, they hand the musettes to the riders. And the riders string them over their shoulders. And they reach into these bags and they eat whatever it is they want. And as they're done, they throw the musettes to the side of the road. And one of the things that you'll find in the Tour de France and in other large stage races is that's where you're going to find the kids hanging out. The young kids like to hang out, the spectators. They like to hang out in that portion of the course because that's where they can pick up these musettes as the riders throw them off their bikes. You've also seen that the racers will actually drink from a water bottle and then throw it to the side of the road. You'll watch the peloton go by, and there's literally bottles going right and left as they're throwing the bottles away. Well, they don't want the extra weight on their bike. Maybe the bottles are getting empty, and they throw them away, and then they can always get more from one of their other teammates who brings them up from one of the team cars and brings them new full water bottles. So that's how they eat and drink when they're out there on the course. Now, one of the things I just mentioned was the team cars. Every team is allowed to have two cars on the race course, and usually one of these cars will have the team director in it. So whether it's Johan Bruneel for Discovery or Bjarne Riis for CSC or any of the other race directors, they're in there and they've got their race radio and they're listening to the official race radio as well as their team radio. So they're actually communicating with their cyclists as their cyclists are out there on the road. So when you're watching the tour, look in the ears of each of these cyclists and you're going to see that they each have an earphone and they literally are able to talk to their team directors during the race, a bit like NASCAR here in the United States. Here in the U.S., we have auto racing and it's very popular for fans to go to these races, to go to the racetracks with radio scanners, and they can listen to the race radio as the guys in the pit crew are talking to the racers while they're out there on the track. Well, same thing in the Tour de France. Now, another thing about the team cars is there's usually a car that's got a mechanic, spare wheels, sometimes even spare bikes, because if you get a flat in the Tour de France, you don't have to change that flat. Your team is allowed to bring you an entirely new wheel that you can then change out, and they can change these wheels out very, very quickly, and then the riders are on the road. If you have some sort of other mechanical problem, a lot of times what will happen, especially if you're one of the main riders on that team, your entire team will stop for you so that when your mechanical gets fixed, they'll get in a pace line and help pull you back up into the peloton. The final question that my kids asked me, and this one's a little bit delicate, but you know, they know that if I'm going to do a century and I'm on my bike for 5 hours, they know that, again, I've got the capability of stopping when nature calls and I need to go to the bathroom. These guys, they don't necessarily have that luxury. So if they've got to go, sometimes what they'll do is the entire peloton will say, all right, at such and such a time, we're all going to slow down. And anybody that needs to go, you go, and we'll allow you to catch up. Because that's part of the sportsmanlike nature of cycling. We'll leave the doping out of it, but that's part of the sportsmanlike nature. There is certain common courtesy among the cyclists and the peloton. So if you've got to go, we're going to slow down for you. There are some cyclists who, in the thick of the race, if they've really got to go, they've become very talented and they have the ability to go while they're still racing. So they don't get off their bike. If they do, it's not for very long. And when they do, typically the peloton will wait for them. So that's just a few things that I thought you should know as you're watching the Tour de France this year, what to look for in the race and some of the common questions that people have about the racers as they're participating in the Tour de France. So enjoy. Now, if you've been listening to the Fredcast for a while, you know that a few weeks ago I talked to you about listener Matt, who was planning on doing the AIDS Life Cycle, which is a benefit ride that goes from San Francisco to Los Angeles. And I gave you the link so that if you wanted to donate to him, you could. And if you did, I appreciate it, and I know that Matt does as well. Well, I finally got an email back from Matt letting me know that he did participate in the ride, and he said that it was one of the most amazing experiences of his life. He told me that the riders and the support people were great. And he says, and this is a quote, "Quite honestly, I've never spent an entire week around people so full of positive energy. He sent me some information about the organization of the event, and it just sounds like it was very, very well organized and an amazing and incredible journey for all of the cyclists as they travel down the California coast. As a matter of fact, Matt says, if you've never been to California or if you haven't spent a whole lot of time here, that this is the way to see the state. So I just wanted to say congratulations to listener Matt, and I'm glad that he did it. It was a great cause. And for those of you who were able to donate, thank you for doing so. Again, very great cause. Very, very much appreciated. And finally, although I have a lot more to tell you, I'm going to sort of cut it off here, but I just wanted to let you know, I wanted to let you in on a piece of information that I thought would be important for you, and that is, we talk a lot about wearing helmets when we ride and about how they really can save us in a crash, but one of the things that I think is also important to talk about is when should you replace your helmet? Now, even if we've talked about this before, it definitely bears repeating. And being as busy as I am and being almost an hour into the podcast, you may be wondering, you know, why am I bringing this up now? Well, it's simple. On Sunday, I was taking a short ride from my house up to a friend's house up in Santa Clarita, California. It's maybe about a 30-mile ride. And it was, I had a great ride. It was fantastic. And literally, just as I was turning the corner to get onto my friend's block, and there was some water there, and I guess that water had been sitting there a while and some algae had been able to grow because it was incredibly slippery, because you know what happened next. I went through that water, bike started to go out from under me, I went to turn out of the skid, and instead of turning out of the skid, I ended up coming right out of the pedals and right over the handlebars, and I crashed. Sat there for a while, and you know, did the analysis of the whole body. The feet are okay, the legs are all right, the arms are fine, the ribs are good, the neck is fine, I can stand up. Got up, inspected my bike, inspected my helmet, and you know, walked the two doors down to my friend's house and sat there for a while, and came home, had dinner, had a shower, and then decided I needed to get checked out. And I got checked out at the emergency room, did a lot of x-rays, literally from head to toe. And when all was said and done, I have nothing broken, just a lot of bruises and some strains, and I'm going to be fine. I figure I'll probably be back on the bike again in probably a day or so. But the reason that I bring this all up is because I looked at my helmet, and I knew that my head had hit the pavement, and there were just some very, very minor indentations in the helmet. And it got me thinking about when it's right to replace your helmet. Now, if you don't know, any time your helmet hits the ground, it needs to be replaced. Now, in my case, again, I'm telling you, these indentations are probably smaller than a quarter. There's two of them. But what you don't see is what can end up getting you in the end, because the outside shell of your helmet is typically a harder plastic, and underneath that is the foam that really is protecting your head. And even though that plastic maybe only has a small indentation or two, the foam might be destroyed to such an extent that it won't protect you in the event of another crash. So I know that my helmet, come tomorrow when the holiday's over, I'm going to the store and I'm going to be replacing it. But there are other situations in which you should consider that you need to replace your helmet. For instance, the sun and your sweat can also degrade the foam that's in your helmet. And as a result, manufacturers typically recommend that if you've had your helmet for 5 years or more, it's time to replace it. Now, certainly, if your helmet is from the 70s or maybe even from the early 80s when there weren't the ANSI and the Snell ratings, and if those stickers aren't in that helmet, you really need a new helmet. If you've got a helmet that you're wearing for skateboarding or for motorcycle riding, that is not the helmet that you should be wearing on your bike. You should have one helmet for cycling and another helmet for skateboarding, because a lot of times those helmets are actually configured differently for the different sports that you are participating in. So again, if your helmet is a little bit too old, if your helmet has been dropped, if you've gone down on your bike and you've hit your head, if there are any indentations in your helmet, it's time to replace it. And if you have any questions, call the manufacturer of your helmet or take your helmet to your local bike shop and have them check it out, because the helmet is there to protect you. And if it's been degraded in any way, should you go down, and all of us at some time or another are going to go down, should you go down, you want to make sure that that helmet is there to protect your head. So I'm going out tomorrow to replace mine. I recommend that you, after you're done listening to the podcast, go check out your helmet, see what kind of shape it's in. It is very, very inexpensive insurance for one of the most important parts of your body. Okay, real quick before we go today, just a couple of upcoming events I wanted to tell you about. Now, I told you last week about the viewing party for the Tour de France on July the 15th in Irvine at the Fox Sports Grill. And this is to benefit the National Multiple Sclerosis Society. I've put a link in the show notes. It's Saturday, July the 15th from 5:30 a.m. to 8:30 a.m. The price is $30, and the ticket price includes entry into the party, a breakfast buffet, a souvenir t-shirt, and two opportunity drawings to win great tickets and supporting a cause that is very important to me, and I hope that you will all plan to attend that one. Now, the next viewing party I wanted to tell you about is up in the Bay Area at the Baysides Sports Bar in the Bay Area. This is taking place on July the 18th. And why the 18th? Because that's in the middle of the week? Simple. That's the Alpe d'Huez stage that I was telling you about earlier. This is taking place Tuesday, July the 18th from 8 p.m. to 11:30 p.m. And I've put a link in the show notes to a flyer that you can download that will tell you all about it. And this one is to benefit the Breast Cancer Fund, something I've told you about on the show before. So plan on attending one of those. It's a great event to support two very, very good causes, as well as to have a chance to hang out with fellow cyclists, enjoy some camaraderie, and enjoy some great cycling from the Tour de France. Finally, two very quick show notes. First, to listener Casey in Valencia, I wanted to say thank you to Casey for sending me the email that I read to you earlier about doping in the world of cycling. Appreciate that, Casey. And finally, very, very special shout out, and one that I should have done a couple of weeks ago, and I apologize for this, but listener Kendall in Utah, I wanted to say thank you to Kendall. Kendall met Greg LeMond when he participated in the Tour de Cure, and Kendall sent me Greg LeMond's autograph. So that was really, really cool. Kendall, I really, really appreciate it. It's hanging here on my office wall, and it's great to have. So thanks a lot. All right, that's going to do it. It is a new month, so I'd like to encourage you all to go out and vote for the Fredcast on Podcast Alley. There is a link in the show notes, as well as a very, very simple voting link on the front page of thefredcast.com. Go to thefredcast.com every day during the Tour de France as I update it with the day's events coming to us from France with the race results. Go ahead and check out the Fredcast forums. People are talking about the Tour de France in there. You can send me email anytime, whether it's a text mail or you want to send me an audio comment, and you can send that to thefredcast@gmail.com. Don't forget the fact that I'm still collecting your comments about your preferred frame material. Prefer to get those in audio comments, but text comments will be all right as well. And as always, you could certainly send me voicemail to the Fredcast listener hotline at area code 206-203-FRED. Finally, as always, PodSafe cycling music for today comes to us from the PodSafe Cycling Network at music.podshow.com. Today's music is sort of a quirky one. It's called Independence Day by Jesta, and I've got links in the show notes to Jesta's website as well as to Jesta's podshow.com website. So that's going to do it for today. I'll be back in a few days with more info on the Tour de France and all your cycling news and features. Until then, enjoy the tour, enjoy the music, but most of all, enjoy the ride.
Everybody's talking about the delivery networks, bandwidth and sponsors and advertiser inserts. Everybody's talking stuff so intellectual. Are you a home fry or a metrosexual? Everybody's talking about net neutrality, biodiesel dreams becoming reality. But just for one day, I'm gonna blow all my cares away. I'm gonna rock out on Independence. is talking about media's future. Time-shifting content, do whatever may suit ya. Everybody's talking about all sorts of rumors. Creative Commons and trusting consumers. Everybody's talking about making a podcast. But there's non-believers who say that it won't last. Well, on the 4th of July, any haters come cough and die. I'm gonna rock out on Independence Day. I don't care what the SEC. Just you and me, we got our freedom, you see.